Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Friday morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mr. Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, an inside look at public records laws and how Dr. Seuss changed literature for generations of children.
But first this hour, it was a late night at the state capitol last night, at least for some lawmakers. The House worked past midnight and approved some of that chamber's budget bills. They're scheduled to reconvene next hour to consider the rest. The Senate, meanwhile, adjourned for the day while it was still light out and is also set to start back up this morning. Joining us now to talk about where things stand is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, I hope you're well caffeinated.
Well, the caffeine is very good. Actually, they could use a little caffeine to keep this place running.
So the House, let's start there, because they actually passed some budget bills last night, but not all of them. Which ones did they do, and why did they choose those?
Well, they chose the ones they did because those are the non-controversial ones. The problem becomes that they're hung up over a couple of issues. Number one is what they call the feed bill. In other words, what are we going to spend money on? There are some lawmakers, particularly Heather Carter and Kate Brophy McGee, who say, look, we're not funding some of the priorities. We've got the money there. Then the other big issue is the tax revenue bill, which deals with how we're going to revamp our state income taxes to take advantage of the fact that some folks are going to be paying mortgages due to federal conformity. Representative J.D. Mesnard is leading the fight on that to make sure that nobody ends up paying more, because as the system is structured now, most of the benefit, at least as proportionally, is going to folks toward the low and moderate end of the income scale, and some of the folks at the upper end may end up paying more. So those are the two big hangups. I mean, yes, they did do the Human Services Budget Bill and the Criminal Justice, what they call a Budget Reconciliation Bill, which are the technical changes they need, but they still haven't done the money bills.
Is there any reason to believe that when they get back this morning, you know, that things will have changed and that people who are no's will become yeses?
Well, somewhere between no and hell no at this point. I think the issue becomes, we've talked about it over and over again, you know, Senator Paul Boyer said, look, I have some key issues here. I want to see us vote on a bill to create a new window for sex abuse victims to be able to sue their assailants. What's been offered so far by the House, he says, is not enough. It really doesn't provide an opportunity for the folks who have been told out of the time, if you will. And he told me this morning, he said, look, nobody has reached out to me. You know, the Senate president hasn't reached out to me. And as long as he's holding out, and as long as Senator Heather Carter, who also has some of the financial issues, is holding out over that sex abuse bill, they're at 15 senators. They need 16. And so far, I haven't seen any Democrats willing to go across the aisle. Now, obviously, that could change. But my guess is I'm working Saturday. I'm hoping you guys will be here.
I don't think that's likely, Howie, I'm sorry to say. So you mentioned the Senate, and it seems as though there is some growing maybe tension between the House and Senate. We've heard some members of the House saying that they're hoping that, I think the phrase was a gentle push maybe, that by the House passing some of the budget bills that would get the Senate moving in that direction as well.
Oh, I think it's more than a gentle push. You know, what happened is somebody got embarrassed because they forgot to turn off some microphones during a closed caucus, and there were some nasty things said about the senators over in the House. That is certainly going to rub people the wrong way. Representative Anthony Kern over in the House told me he's expecting an apology from Senator Paul Boyer. Senator Boyer told him, don't hold your breath. So there's no love lost here. And I think they'll make some progress on some of the issues today, but not a lot. Now let's point out the one area that they did find some agreement on yesterday, which is, hey, we need to raise our per diem. We need to triple our per diem. Now, everyone is singing kumbaya on that. So who says they can't work together?
That's right. When it comes to some money issues, I guess they can get along. So, Howie, do you get the sense that the budget that they are negotiating and in some cases voting on now, like, is this the framework for what will ultimately pass? Or is this maybe sort of a test run for another sort of new budget that will have to come down at some other time?
Well, again, remember that the bills that the House passed are what they call reconciliation bills. These are the bills to put into practice the money that they will eventually approve. I don't think they're going to approve the money bills until they have a deal. Now, the House may decide, okay, we'll dare the Senate. We'll put out our money bill and dare them to not approve it. And, you know, I can see all sorts of horrible things happening from that. You know, we're at a point where, you know, tempers are raw, you know, people are frustrated. And they may try to see, well, look, what's the worst that could happen? The Senate could say no. And we could be here Saturday. And Senate President Karen Fann said, okay, I'll give you Sunday off, but we're going to be back Memorial Day if we don't get out of here.
And how
the problem becomes they're losing people next week.
Right. And we should point out that, you know, irrespective of the rarity of coming in on a Saturday and or a holiday Monday, just being there on a Friday, not being held over from Thursday night, that's a pretty rare thing.
Oh, it's a very rare thing. You know, sometimes at the end of the session, if they're making progress, I mean, what usually happens is if they're actually moving, they will actually work overnight. You know, they'll work past midnight with the idea of, you know, adjourning at 5 a.m. You know, there's been more than one time that I've watched the sunrise over the state capitol because I knew there was an end in sight and that the light at the end of the tunnel was not an oncoming freight train. At this point, that light is flickering.
Interesting. All right. That is Howie Fisher. Howie, I'm sure we'll be checking back in with you. I hope the coffee keeps flowing for you. Thank you very much.
Oh, please just send caffeine tabs.
In addition to the budget, state lawmakers are also considering a bill that would allow some students on the Navajo Nation to continue using their empowerment scholarship accounts at a New Mexico private school. Current law prohibits families who get the vouchers from using the money out of state, and a recent audit from the state education department found these families, whose applications had been approved a couple of years ago. The bills in the House and Senate each have bipartisan support, including from my next guest, State Senator Jamesita Peshlakai. She represents that part of the state, and she joins me. And Senator, first off, are you happy with the bill moving through the legislature to try to resolve the situation?
Well, first of all, I was not happy with finding out the news on Saturday afternoon. And apparently I was the legislative district representatives were basically one of the last people to be told about the issue. And the issue began 2 years ago when the previous superintendent, the ESAs were approved for usage in New Mexico. And I think it was actually a real oversight and not intentional because from what I understand, Hilltop Christian School has a post office box in Window Rock, which is about half a mile from their actual building. On Saturday evening, I saw a press release go out from Senator Gray and Representative Peterson saying they were going to run a bill, doing everything they could to help. My colleagues and I, my seatmates, went in on Monday, sat down with Superintendent of Schools and told them what we had seen as far as the Republican draft was not something that we could, as representatives of the district, support. So we sat down at the table with Superintendent Hoffman and our staff, and we redid the language of the bill, and we thought it was fair because we did not want the families penalized. And so the new bill language would give them not only the year to transition out, but also leave them, not require them to repay the money. And then also the expansion of empowerment scholarship account usage would not be expanded into other states.
Well, as you know, that was one of the concerns. You referenced it just a moment ago, that you were concerned that by addressing this particular case, that it would sort of be a first step toward maybe expanding the ESA program. It sounds like you're not concerned about that, given the current language in the bill.
Yes, but it's something that's always going to be a concern. And one of the things that is really truly at the heart of this issue is equity. Equity for the 55,000 plus Native American students in the state of Arizona. Equity for those that don't have the option of going to a private school or don't have the option of going to a Christian religious school if they are come from a traditional family.
Is it your expectation that this bill will really sort of take care of this issue? I mean, do you expect or do you think that there might be cases of other students and families who are in a similar situation who maybe just weren't part of the most recent audit?
I believe so. And my colleagues from other parts of the state said, yeah, there are issues in their communities that they find similar problems, like along the Arizona borders with the other states. And also, and I'm not in any way an expert on this, but I hear issues with students possibly along the Mexico and Arizona borders that this could affect. And I don't think it would be a serious problem if folks weren't so eager to expand the Empowerment Scholarship Account program. I myself, as a product of public school education, back in the 1980s, we had the greatest quality of education at Tuba City High School. And we had wonderful teachers, wonderful extracurricular activities, a great athletic program. And to this day, that is because of the budget cuts and the changes in standards for teachers. It's just been chipping away at the education system. And this is one of the problems that has come about because many of the schools in my district are considered failing schools. But if we don't address the problem and allow money to go out of state, we are not being responsible to our constituents. We're not being responsible to the future of our children. And it is something that we need to address now.
All right. That is Arizona State Senator Jamesita Peshlakai. Senator, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Alleging violations of water quality laws, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has filed a $100 million civil lawsuit against Johnson Utilities. The violations cited include sewer overflows and failure to maintain enough water in pipes to serve customers. Arizona Republic reporter Ryan Randazzo has been covering the story and is with us. Ryan, good morning.
Morning.
So let's do a very brief, if possible, history of the Johnson Utilities issues out there in the East Valley. This is just sort of a culmination of a lot of things, right?
It is. They've been having problems that are cited in this lawsuit back to 2007 with sewers overflowing, with low water pressure so people can't shower or flush their toilet twice in a row. There's toxic odors coming from one of the treatment plants and just sort of myriad problems with the water and sewer system out there in the far East Valley. We're talking about the area roughly between Queen Creek and Florence.
So $100 million obviously sounds like an enormous amount of money. Put that in context for us. And also, what would the $100 million go toward eventually? I thought there were some infrastructure issues there that maybe some of the money would be used to fix those.
Yeah, it's an eye-popping figure. But most of the fines for, you know, having a manhole back up and raw sewage dump in the street are like $25,000 a day. And there's dozens of those in this suit. But what they're actually looking for is to fix the problems. And to fix the problems out there means to replace some of these treatment plants that are just haven't been maintained over the years because the profits from the company were going to a management company that was hired. So all of the money that customers out in that area pay for their water and sewer bills has been going to the Johnson family and not back into the pipes and pumps and things that are needed to get water to their house and to take their wastewater away.
So, Ryan, how is a problem like this able to fester in such a manner? When you talk about the Johnson family and how they decided to use some of the money, as you just said, is there simply a case of not enough regulation? The Johnsons have been around a long time. Is there an actual specific reason for this?
Well, that's a great question. And it's one that the corporation commissioners, the people who regulate our utilities, are really grappling with because they've had oversight of this company. They've been aware of these problems. They've brought the company in many times to address these issues. And somehow the people out there, the customers, still are under the threat of not having water in their taps this summer because the system's been so poorly maintained. It's gotten to the point where the commissioners are actually considering taking away the, they call it a CCNN. That's a technical term that means it's the right for Johnson to serve that area. That is just very rare that you would take away a utility's territory and possibly sell or give it to somebody else. But the discussion has gotten there at the Corporation Commission.
Well, that concern about the summer, obviously, just around the corner. So what are the possibilities there in terms of the water supply for folks out there?
Well, what happened last year is they had a pump failure. And so they had several days where people had just extremely low water pressure. There were schools that had to use bottled water to flush their toilets. There were customers complaining again that they couldn't take a shower, that they just had such low water pressure, it was almost nothing at their house. The company now, I should note, is being run by a separate company called EPCOR USA. They run other water companies, water utilities around the country. The state regulators put EPCOR in charge because Johnson wasn't running the system well. So at least there's someone different to respond to problems. And EPCOR has started to try and patch the system and buy some spare parts so that if there is a pump failure on a well, that everyone's taps don't go dry. But I heard a pretty concerned EPCOR official this week at the Corporation Commission just saying that, you know, the margin is very slim. It's not like other utilities where they have backups and backups to the backups. Because, you know, the rest of us are pretty lucky if you don't live in this territory. I mean, I live in the city of Tempe. Having my tap go dry is not something that I'm accustomed to. It would be quite a shock, but that's actually something that, unfortunately, some of these customers have become accustomed to.
Yeah, and no doubt you reached out to Johnson Utilities. Did they have anything to say about this?
They did not. George Johnson, the sole manager of Johnson Utilities, has hired a PR firm. I, of course, reached out to them immediately. I got them on the phone yesterday. And they just did not have a comment on this lawsuit. Again, it's a pretty striking number, but I think really what the Attorney General and the Department of Environmental Quality are going at here is they want the system to be replaced. And now that EPCOR is in charge, I think they're really just trying to force Johnson to replace some of these outdated sewage systems and water systems.
All right. That is Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic. Ryan, have a good weekend. Thanks.
You too. Bye.
On Wednesday, the organization that represents military families released a highly critical report about the conditions of private military housing. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie is here to talk about what was in that report, which was produced by the Military Family Advisory Network, and what will be done to improve the situation for thousands of military families. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Mark.
So you talked to a former military family member earlier this week about their living conditions, and it sounds like based on this report, they weren't alone.
Yeah. You know, that family was stationed at Davis Monthan in Tucson, and they were dealing with asbestos shingles. Elizabeth Robertson was pregnant at the time, and her husband was on active duty then. Robertson and her husband, Christopher, spent months going back and forth with a private company called Soaring Heights. At one point, the company told Robertson that they're not bound by any military rules, but they claim to abide by the Federal Fair Housing Act.
We talked with them, the fair housing people, for a while, went back to Soaring Heights and said, hey, listen, this is what you say you abide by. If you don't abide by military law, then you say you abide by federal law. And they said, oh, no, we don't have to do that because we work on a military base. So it's based on rank structure. And we're like, well, what, you know, who's in charge at this point? There's, you don't have anybody that you're accountable to.
That sounds really frustrating. So, Kathy, how many families participated in this survey?
About 16,000 families, which was surprising even to the organization that worked on the survey. I spoke with Shannon Razadin, and she's the executive director of the Military Family Advisory Network, and she touched on the issue of accountability.
We heard a wide range of issues, but it was consistent that families were having problems with maintenance, repairs, remediation. There's little or to no recourse for families as far as issues with their homes or fees that they're charged.
Now, the report found 60% of families surveyed had difficulties with maintenance or repair issues. But, Kathy, it sounds like it was more than that, right?
Yeah, and I'll let Shannon Razadin speak to that.
These are not, you know, one-off things like our dishwasher's not working. This is our dishwasher's not working. We've had people come out 5 times. Each time it floods our home. The flooding of our home leads to mold. And so it's something that families are dealing with this. They're often isolated. You're moving every 2.5 years. It's a forced readiness issue if you have a service member deployed and worried about the safety of their family and their home.
Something I want to point out that she told me, which was really striking, was these families were normalizing their living conditions. She said families were saying things like, well, we have mold in our home, but it's okay.
Now, Razadin talks about military readiness. This has to have a significant impact, I would think, on morale and focus. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, I talked to Senator Martha McSally about that, who, as you know, served in the military. And I'll tell you, she is very angry about all of this.
This is also a readiness issue where you think that person, that soldier or airman or sailor or marine, is actually going to be focused on the mission when they know their family is struggling and unsafe and no one's being responsive to it. So this is where, again, commanders need to get back in the process and be held accountable, and tenants need to have information, transparency, timeliness, responsiveness, and rights.
So, Kathy, did Senator McSally say what she intends to do about this?
Well, she said that the defense bill that she's working on has a lot of initiatives that could help ameliorate issues facing military families, like a tenant's bill of rights, for example. So if there's an issue like asbestos or mold, those families could then withhold rent. One last thing I wanted to mention about these private companies. Robertson told me that the company they were dealing with threatened to report her husband to his commander. And she says other families face similar threats. I told McSally about that. And she said if that is the case, it is unacceptable.
All right. That is KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. Thanks, Kathy.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on KJZZ. Thanks for listening on this Friday morning. With Mark Brody and Amy Walter at The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. Getting perspective is hard to do when we're constantly overstimulated as we are now. Our phones buzz with breaking news alerts. Our TV screens are filled with panels of partisan commentators telling us this is the most important, most consequential, most terrible thing that anyone has ever seen. Political reporters and their twitchy Twitter fingers are constantly serving up their hot takes of each and every twist and turn on the campaign trail. And President Trump is participating fully in the process, stirring up chaos and controversy with every tweet. It's fair to wonder at this point if this is the new normal. And if we are at a tipping point in the presidency or a constitutional crisis, how do we know we're there? Here's co-host Amy Walter with Barbara Perry, the director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center.
Given all the discussion about the potential for a constitutional crisis, I asked her how she thought the presidency of Richard Nixon, the most recent president to challenge the bounds of the Constitution, fit into all of this.
The inflection point about Richard Nixon is really one more about the entire constitutional structure. Because if you think of it, what Richard Nixon did and what he was accused of doing and what he would have been impeached for and convicted and removed from office if the process had played out in the Congress was that each of the three branches, and I would even include the media, which are sometimes referred to as a fourth branch of government, I would say all of them in the constitutional structure that the founders had envisioned it would work, were all working together to come to justice, to find this president to be guilty of these high crimes and misdemeanors, even though, again, the impeachment process didn't carry out because the Supreme Court went to work with the Tapes case. Congress went to work with impeachment proceedings underway in the House and in the Senate Watergate Committee. And by virtue of what's happening in the media through television coverage and newspaper coverage that everyone knows about through All the President's Men, you end up with these leaders of the Republican Party who were in the minority. Granted, they were in the minority in the House and the Senate at that time. They march down to the White House after the Supreme Court issues its ruling against Richard Nixon in the tapes case, and they say, Mr. President, we can't save you. There's no way that you can stay in office. You will be impeached. You will be convicted. You will be removed.
So the Constitution and the way that the founders had hoped actually worked.
It did. And it's the perfect example. I think it's almost a, while it was horrible for the country to have to go through it, it's a pristine example of the separation of powers and the checks and balances at this delicate balance working to perfection.
Let's fast forward to this time that we're in, where the conventional wisdom, or at least what a lot of people are talking about, is the fact that these checks and balances are no longer in balance. Do you believe that we are in a constitutional crisis at this moment? And if not, what does that look like?
I think we are at the cusp of a constitutional crisis. And I say that because of the inflection point, the crossroads, whatever term you want to use or metaphor to describe the Donald Trump presidency. It remains to be seen how this crisis will develop, and will it become as difficult and as dangerous for the country as Watergate was? And it still remains to be seen whether the delicate balance of separation of powers and checks and balances will work as the founders had hoped. But so far, they are not.
I asked Barbara if there's a right way to set a president's legacy.
Generally, when we look at presidents, we typically are, I always say, we as American people are really good and positive about new presidents typically, although not the incumbent. But you probably know better than I that virtually all presidents since polling started in the modern era from Harry Truman onward get a huge bump forward as they come into office in this honeymoon period. So way more people approve of them than voted for them. And that depends on how long that lasts, but for Trump did not get it at all. So that's one difference right there. And then to the legacy question, Americans are usually really good to ex-presidents. And I call it the Johnny We Hardly Knew Ye phenomenon, because that was a book written about President Kennedy, this gauzy, golden, nostalgic piece by Dave Powers and Ken O'Donnell, who were his two best political friends and aides in the White House. And it came from an Irish ballad, a sentimental Irish ballad, Johnny We Hardly Knew Ye. What was lost with his assassination. But Americans were that way about Bush 41, for example. They turned him out of office after only one term. And my colleague Russell Riley points to the fact that within the 2 months between Bush's defeat and his leaving office, his approval ratings went up 20 points from where he had landed in the popular vote, which was about 36%. He was already over 50% approval rating as he walked out the door and Bill Clinton took his place. Maybe in some way as sort of a buyer's remorse. Georgie, we hardly knew ye. Mm-hmm. And just look at when he passed recently, how people looked back on the heroic George H.W. Bush. So part of it is the passage of time. Now, having said that,
the passage of time is also not very kind to certain presidents.
Correct. And it has not been for the founders. Harry Truman's another example of those leaving with real low approval ratings and then bounding upward in the 1970s when people contrasted him with Richard Nixon, and the music group Chicago had this song called America Needs You, Harry Truman, Harry, Won't You Come Back Home?
The world is turning round and losing lots of ground. Oh, Harry, is there something we can do to save the land we love?
And his oral history came out at that time. It was called Plain Speaking. So another example of Americans loving an ex-president. But the opposite is happening in the post-civil rights era, in the Me Too movement era, as we look back at the presidents of the founding. Washington, Jefferson, as you mentioned, Madison, Monroe, all slaveholders. Jackson, a slaveholder and Indian removal instigator, a genocide of sorts. Woodrow Wilson, who also attended this university, at least for a portion of his time in law school before he went on for a PhD in political science, an outright racist that we know. Here's how I've come to reconcile this. And I'm going to borrow this in part from John Meacham, who spoke last night at Monticello to our dinner. He said, let's look back at these founders and what they stood for in a good way. They stood for the rights of man, and I use man because they only thought in terms of rights of white men. But I always used to say about Thomas Jefferson to my students, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Meacham said last night, that's the greatest line in the English language. And he didn't see to it. Jefferson didn't see to it that we fulfilled it in his lifetime, and our country didn't see to it that we fulfilled it for many decades to come. And some would argue we still haven't fulfilled it, but we usually are moving upward towards it. But we could only get there by Thomas Jefferson placing that language into the Declaration of Independence. And we could only come to this amazing constitutional delicate balance by James Madison writing the Constitution and then adding the Bill of Rights to it that become a model for the world. And so I want to look back on them and say, one, they stood for union, they stood for unity, they stood for the rights of man at a time when it wasn't at all clear that that's where the world was moving. So they were men of the Enlightenment. They were also men of their age that had much darker sides. And so that Enlightenment is always fighting against the dark. And that's when we look back at historians and judge them, I think sometimes it depends on one's viewpoint, if one goes with their darker side or their light side. I tend to be an optimistic person, and I tend to be a person whose view has fallen out of disfavor in the academy, and that is I do see the United States as an exceptional country. We're not perfect. We don't always get it right. In fact, sometimes we get it terribly wrong. But in the end, I think we are always moving towards the Enlightenment side of the founding rather than the darker side.
And that's Barbara Perry, Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, talking with Amy Walter at The Takeaway. The ACLU and the ACLU of Arizona are suing Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery over public records. They say the county attorney's stonewalling and delay tactics in response to a large public records request submitted by investigative journalist Sean Holstage is illegal.
The ACLU of Arizona hired Holstage to collect information about policies, procedures, budget, and employees from several county attorneys in the state. But while other officers have at least partially complied, they say Montgomery's office has not.
The county attorney's office sees it differently. Their representative told KJZZ in a statement that the request was 6 pages long, with more than 200 discrete items in it over a 6-year period. The office says the request is not being ignored, but it'll take some time to fulfill, especially since the office has received an increasing number of public records requests in recent years.
In fact, that office sent us a few photos of their records office showing boxes lining two of the walls.
So what exactly are the laws surrounding public records, and what are they meant to accomplish? For more on that, our co-host Lauren Gilger turned to Joseph Russomano, a First Amendment expert and professor of media law at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
So let's start by sort of outlining what the laws are here. Like, when it comes to public records laws and what agencies, what government agencies are required to do, what is it?
Well, I think the key here with the Arizona law is that it requires prompt response. That is literally the word that is in the law. And it's the one that everybody seems to fall back on. Of course, therein lies the problem is how do we define prompt? It is subjective. I have no doubt that the law was written with that in mind for it to be somewhat open-ended, somewhat fluid in how it's defined, because what's reasonably prompt in one situation may not be so reasonable in another situation. So it allows for that flexibility, and I think that's a good thing overall. But I think by any definition, when you get into the hundreds of days where there hasn't been an adequate response, I think anyone would consider that being anything but prompt.
And agencies are required to hand over most information that is public. But what does that mean also? Like, they don't have to turn over everything in every instance, correct?
Correct. In all of these kinds of laws, both state and the Freedom of Information Act on the federal level, there are exemptions, whether they're specifically outlined as they are in the federal law or somewhat more loosely laid out in some of the state laws. But the government entity, which whatever one we're talking about in a given situation, does have outs, if you will, a legal ability to deny some records or at least to redact what they consider to be sensitive information in a particular record that's been requested.
Is that also subjective?
Absolutely. It can be. And one of the problems that you have with all of these laws, federal, state, local level, is that when these decisions need to be made, does a particular record, for example, fall under an exemption? Well, who's making that decision? Well, it's the agency that the record has been requested from in the first place. So it's a little bit, some people would say more than a little bit, like the fox watching the hen house, that the government gets to make that decision itself.
But that is the way the law is written.
Yes.
So has the landscape shifted here? Like, is it getting more difficult, and has it for maybe the last decade or so gotten more difficult for journalists to get records from departments in general?
On the whole, I would say yes. And, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that it's not just journalists who have the ability to use these laws, but it's any citizen, okay, with the idea of open government, transparency in government being the primary goal there. But I think the answer is yes. As more information becomes available, as more information is produced, there is more demand for various pieces and parts of that information. At the same time, you've got government agencies, again, on all levels of government, that are in financial binds. They don't have the kind of staff that they used to have. And so what suffers? Well, this is one of those areas that does, is there just isn't the staff devoted to fielding these requests in ways that there used to be.
Yeah. So at the same time that it might have gotten more difficult for journalists or others to get these records, it's also gotten more difficult for those agencies, for the departments. What are the challenges? I mean, staffing's one of them, right? But is it often like when you get a very extensive request, difficult to fulfill?
Well, I would, to be fair, I would probably defer first and foremost to someone who has done this. But what we tend to see is that, yeah, there can be, depending on the request, depending on the intricacies that may be involved in it, you can have a bit of a needle in the haystack sort of challenge. We like to think, and the facts bear this out, that in a digital age, as more and more records have been digitized, that the ease of finding them has increased. So while the demand is higher, we would like to think that the ease of finding them, at least to some extent, counterbalances that.
So what's the idea behind these laws in general? As you look at the landscape shifting and the way they sort of work today, are they working? Are they functioning the way these laws were meant to function?
A lot wrapped up in that. Are they functioning the way they are supposed to? No. I think that is clear, and there are organizations out there who have been monitoring these, and their conclusion is unequivocal. No, these are not working anywhere nearly as well as they should. Is it a good thing that we have these laws? Yes. But do they need to work better in addition to that? Yes. And there are all kinds of pitfalls. Many of the critics say there needs to be more in the way of enforcement, of making sure that the laws are implemented and followed in the way that they were intended to be. And again, this applies to both the national and local levels. But in terms of the you know, what these laws are meant to do, you know, it really goes back to the founding of the country. And even at that time, the notion of accountability on the part of the government, our founders, remember, did not trust the government. They did not trust themselves. And so these laws are an extension of that, the notion that the citizens who really are sovereign in terms of running the country, theoretically at least, should have access to the information of what their leaders are doing. So it's about getting to the truth, you know, something that is we see surfacing now and then in the news these days, and the importance of that, of populating our marketplace of ideas with as much information and facts as we choose to access. And when these sorts of things are ignored, many would say it's a step toward authoritarianism. That it no longer is a government of, by, and for the people, but that instead the government, and not we the people, as our Constitution demands, are running the country.
Mm-hmm. All right. Joseph Russomanno is professor with ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
When we were kids, we all read his books, even though many of the words seemed like gobbledygook. There was Green Eggs and Ham and Cat in the Hat, The Sneetches and The Lorax, all stories that kids still read and some know by heart. But the man behind them had a very different start to his writing career than you might expect. So to get all the details, I went and checked with an author who wrote all about Dr. Seuss. And as for these clunky rhymes, I beg your excuse. Brian J. Jones is a biographer. His new book is called Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, and the Making of an American Imagination. I caught up with him recently to talk about the author of some of the most well-known children's books of all time and asked him about Geisel's advertising career and whether his later work was influenced by what he did while creating ad campaigns for some pretty big companies.
Oh, definitely. I mean, part of what you learn when you're doing advertising is to make every word count. And, you know, to write concisely and to write to the point, which is exactly what he has to do, especially in books like Cat in the Hat and books moving forward from the Beginner Book imprint, where he was working deliberately within a very confined and restrictive word list. It was a word list that was educator approved. It was the word list that was in the Dick and Jane reading primers. So he had practice in working with short sentences, short words, you know, very quick plots from those days doing advertising. The other place where he really learned how to be concise and learned how to, you know, make plot count the most was when he was in the Signal Corps during World War II. He was stationed in California making propaganda films, but his commanding officer was Frank Capra. And Frank Capra is the one who, you know, would put his scripts down in front of him and say, I'm going to underline everything in your script in blue that advances your plot. And when I hand this back to you, if there's not very much blue in here, you have a problem. So Capra's the one that really taught him, again, how to make every word count. So he really came into writing these books that had these tightly restrictive vocabularies, very comfortable working within it because he had done that in advertising, where his very famous ad campaign was Quick Henry the Flit, four right. words, every one of them matters.
How much of a departure from what had been was Dr. Seuss when he started writing kids' books, Mulberry Street, Bartholomew Cubbins, especially some of those early ones?
Right. No, great question, because that was one of the things I found really fascinating about him, and ultimately one of the reasons we called the book Becoming Dr. Seuss, is because he's got sort of three different arcs of his career, and those early books come out more from not because he wanted to necessarily tell compelling stories for kids, though that certainly is what happened to him later in his career, but Mulberry Street comes out of him feeling sort of creatively stifled by doing advertising work at that time. He was in these very restrictive contracts with Standard Oil, for example, while he's doing the campaigns for bug spray and for motor oil, and can't do a lot of outside projects, but one of the things he was permitted to do were kids' books. So he writes Mulberry Street because it's something that's not prohibited under his contract and finds out he's pretty good at it. So that one's written in verse. And then he does the 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, which is not in verse. But he starts experimenting with the form and doing different things in his work and in his books. And he ends up writing Horton Hatches the Egg as sort of his big book before World War II happens. But that's the first arc of his career. What happens eventually is once you get to Cat in the Hat, that's when he starts working within the pedagogy, working within those pre-approved word lists, creating these books that really do teach kids how to read, but are doing them in a fun and compelling way. So that evolves from his work that starts off just telling kids stories. And something like Bartholomew Cubbins is almost a traditional fairy tale almost. It's got kings and castles in it. So the work really sort of changes in both its tenor and intent over his career.
Did you get the sense that maybe he also evolved in the sense of wanting to write kids' books? I mean, you write about it, and you just mentioned how he started off doing it almost because he was able to and needed to do something else. But it kind of sounds like he didn't really set out to become, you know, perhaps the world's foremost children's author.
Right. And in fact, he almost gets derailed from writing kids' books several times in his career. Hollywood really turns his head at one point. After World War II, he starts going in and touching up movie scripts, and he writes a movie, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, which ends up tanking and sort of saves us from having Dr. Seuss sucked away by Hollywood. But a lot of things are sort of turning his head because he was never quite certain if it was a career that he wanted to do for a living or whether it was worthy of doing for a living. He really does have this sort of epiphany in 1949. He teaches a writing course out of the University of Utah, and that's the moment in his career when he has to kind of write it all down and write down how he writes books and how he illustrates them and how he comes up with verse and how he comes up with plots. And I think that's the moment that things sort of gel in his head, that he's like, you know what, this is really important work, and this is a good profession. And so that's the moment he starts really committing himself to doing that full time. That said, it still takes him a little while. He has to keep doing the ad campaign work to pay the bills. He can't really start writing kids' book full time until Cat in the Hat comes along in 1957. By then, he's 53 years old before he has a first big blockbuster that permits him to write kids' books full time.
How did he think about the balance between writing kids' books that kids would want to read and would be fun, but also, you know, having them have some kind of at least decent lesson for them at the end of it?
Well, he often cautioned people to try not to write books that were intentionally preachy or, you know, seemed intentionally messagey. He really sweated the end of The Grinch, for example, because he didn't want it to be too overtly, you know, moral. And he ends up doing the Brotherhood of Man ending where they all sit down and they break bread together. So he really tried to be sure he wasn't being too overtly preachy or, you know, appeared to have an agenda. Now, that said, he did several times in his career intentionally do that. Yertle the Turtle, for example, is him taking on Adolf Hitler. In fact, he says he almost drew Yertle with a Hitler mustache at one point. The Lorax is a book that he said, I wrote because I was mad. He was watching development sort of encroach on the hillside where his studio was in La Jolla, California, and really wanted to say something about managing our resources responsibly. So that one, you know, that's another one that had an intentional agenda. So he often said that he would leave you to decide what you thought the message was, and I don't think there was a wrong answer for him, but there were several times that he did actually set out to say something, and those are two really good examples of that.
What do Geisel make of his career, especially toward the end? Looking back at, you know, 60-plus years of making kids' books, what did he think about it?
You know, he had come to the point where he knew what he did was important. He knew he was good. He was actually somewhat frustrated late in his career that he thought he wasn't getting enough credit for doing a lot of great things. He was thrilled when he finally got the Pulitzer Prize very late in his career because I don't think he would ever say it publicly, but he really thought he was worth it. He thought he was worthy of the Pulitzer Prize, and he got a Pulitzer Prize that was aimed at the entirety of his body of work, not just a particular project, which is probably the way it should be for Dr. Seuss. So I think he knew he was good. He was comfortable with his legacy. He knew he had made reading fun. And I think that, to him, was the most important part of his legacy, is he chased Dick and Jane out of the classroom with the Cat in the Hat, you know, sweeping them out the door along with thing one and thing two. I think that's one of the things he was the proudest of.
All right. That's Brian J. Jones, author of Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, and the Making of an American Imagination. Brian, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Mark, my pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. And now the moment we've all been waiting for. It's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This is not new. We go through this every year. This is my ninth year here. And quite honestly, yes, we do have members every year that says, I am not voting on the budget unless I get X. And we just have to keep working through that.
There is a tax cut in here. And it's called a tax cut. We can call it any other name, sort of like a pig. We can call it any other name, but we know exactly what it is.
We're making it so that by the time if a district actually gets fined, it would have to be a very egregious situation where the district knew about the problem and didn't act to fix it even after the first warning.
We don't go over our budget. The people in my district love me because I'm always out there. I'm talking to them. I'm solving problems for them because I'm listening to them. I'm in their backyards seeing what the problem is.
And here with us to talk about the latest, the legislature and budget negotiations and probably nothing else, are Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic and Sam Richard of Creosote Partners. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Yeah, good morning.
All right, Marcus, I'm going to go to you first because you have a little bit more experience than Mr. Richard.
Uh-oh.
So what the heck is going on down there right now?
It's just love and peace. They just really want to hug it out.
That seems to be what's happening.
You know, it's the president's right in that intro that you did. I mean, this does happen every year, and it's I don't think anybody who's been doing this for a while is shocked that things are tense right now as you get towards the end. They're in over 130 days. You know, you're near the end. You've run out of bills, and we're focusing on the budget. The reality of the matter is the budget's actually pretty good, and that's not where the fight is. The fight's over sort of this last-minute bill on subject matter having to do with the statute of limitations on child abusers. And Senator Boyer is very impassioned. And the bill, I'm not too sure the bill actually got its rightful place during the – it wasn't debated like a regular bill. And there's been a series of those bills that are happening late in the session. And generally when those – bills aren't debated openly and transparently, it causes a lot more friction in the institution. And I think we're seeing that rooted out in these last several days.
Now, Sam, Marcus said a lot there. I want you to comment on some of it. But first of all, is it a pretty good budget that most lawmakers and the governor think is all right?
It's a loaded question.
Yes.
But I think what I would say is I think that there's a lot in here that make a lot of diverse constituencies happy. There's a lot in here that make a lot of folks unhappy. And that's usually the sign of something that has been battled out and put a lot of work into over the course of the year. And I think that it's also very indicative of the close numbers, right? You have 31-29 in the House and you have a relatively narrow margin in the Senate from a partisanship view. So the governor and legislative leaders knew that the starting point couldn't have been on the fringes from the get, right? So you had to start with something that was in the middle, and obviously Marcus alluded to some of those issues that are going to be there through the weekend or, you know, through the end of June, who knows? But I think, yeah, to button that up, I think that there's quite a lot in here that gives plenty of reason for folks to be happy, but there's also a lot that is left to be desired.
Marcus, you mentioned that, you kind of alluded to the fact that tensions are running a little high down there. How much does that play into the negotiation? Because obviously, you know, we think of lawmakers, people who care about their issues, but at the end of the day, these are human beings. And if somebody says something, for example, on a microphone that they didn't know was open about somebody else, that other person might be kind of ticked at them.
Oh, yeah, it definitely has a big effect. And what you're sort of alluding to is about 7 minutes last night of what was supposed to be a closed-door meeting with the Republicans that they had a hot mic. And so the mic was open, and they said a lot of things that that they really wish that they could take back. And you know, I think all of us have learned that lesson at one point in our life because we all deal with microphones a lot. So be careful. Treat them like they're always on. They didn't. And I think that there are at least a couple members that I know regret that and have publicly said, look, I was a little hot under the collar. But you can see how that causes trouble when you're trying to negotiate some of these finer things. Cooler heads will prevail at the end of the day. It might take some time to get there.
Yes, and there's been talk of maybe working tomorrow, maybe working Memorial Day Monday, maybe you alluded to working maybe through the end of June. Is this a long-term thing or a short-term thing at this point?
Well, I think the end of June thing is just that's the real actual deadline, right?
End of the fiscal
Arizona,
year.
Right. Arizona is not the federal government. We have to have a budget in place by June 30th, so that's the real deadline. The open questions are, where the pressures are for folks' vacation schedules. You know, it's graduation time, and a lot of folks are at the age where their children are graduating either from high school or college, right? So there's a lot of things that people have historically, because of the norms of the legislature, had kind of June to do those sorts of things. So if the thought is that if we don't get done this weekend, there's this really huge, like, open black hole of really difficult math to get to 16 and 31.
And that, again, goes back to the numbers you mentioned earlier.
Right.
I mean, there would be enough members, in theory, to vote on a budget, but not enough Republican members.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. And that's really where a lot of the tension is.
I always find it somewhat humorous that we're dealing with this, you know, we got to get out of session, we got to get out of session. You don't. You actually don't. You're getting paid to do a job, and what you have to do is actually do a budget by June, and that was the most important component. But as that deals with these legislative subjects that are very important, like the statute of limitations on child abusers, this is a pretty important issue. I know I'm preaching to the choir with a bunch of dads sitting around here reading the stories that are on the front page of the paper. But my point is this: let's get it right the first time. Don't worry about you have to get out because you're tired or it's hot. Just work the issue, calm down, figure it out, and let's do it right the first time.
Marcus, you mentioned getting paid to do a job. Apparently, lawmakers have decided on a bipartisan basis they should get paid a little bit more to do their job at the Capitol.
I was wondering when we were going there. it is bipartisan. Democrats and Republicans do agree on one thing. They want a pay increase. Shocking. The problem with this one is, one, it was introduced late in the legislative session. And by late, I mean the other day. And two, late at night, which is not, for visual purposes, not the greatest messaging. And three, had little to no debate. The House and the Senate are going to be voting on those proposals. It'll probably about, I think the math is about triple for some members, what they bring home in pay. But as you can see, I mean, it leads to this messaging point of, you guys are happy to pay yourselves more money, but, you know, what about the teachers? What about Department of Corrections employees? What about roads and infrastructure? And I can keep going on and on. And so that will play in undoubtedly during the campaign season.
Yeah, Sam, optics, of course, we talk about perception being reality. In this case, something like that, when you consider how long the session is, as Marcus said, woe is us, we still have to keep doing this. It doesn't look that great to sneak in some extra cash.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that, to Marcus's point, I don't think that very many people disagree with the fact that our legislators do an important job and that they should be compensated in a manner that's fair. But this issue should have had, you know, committee hearings and the chance for the public to provide input and things like that. But, I mean, the optics are just too juicy to ignore, and legislative leadership ignored those optics.
And I think Sam and I would both be the first people to tell you these people do need a raise. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt about it. There hasn't been one for a number of years. And two, when you math out the amount of time that they actually put into that job, they're making well less than minimum wage. So to that point, they do deserve a pay increase. The problem is how we're going about doing that. And it'll be interesting because they're setting themselves up. I assume that they've had a conversation with the governor and the governor's green-lighted this. But, there is that possibility of getting a veto. And then you're sitting on the worst of all circumstances.
You mentioned that, you know, legislators, they don't get paid very much. I think it's $24,000. And they cannot adjust their actual salaries. This is a per diem thing, how much they get, you know, for meal and lodging and travel and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, the voters are the ones who have to approve or disapprove. In the case, most times it's disapprove pay increases. Do you think that this changes in any way the next time that comes up? Do you think that it becomes part of the campaign? Hey, look, you know, legislators just gave themselves more in a per diem. Why do we need to give them more pay?
I mean, I think they definitely just wrote the opposition piece for the next time that conversation comes up. And, you know, I think that there are plenty of ways to kind of have this, like, good government overhaul, you know, maybe looking at a year-long session. Don't hit me. or just things like actual, you know, maybe doing something like tying a legislator's pay to the average pay of a teacher in Arizona, right? So that there's some shared incentives, some shared burden. But you can't have those types of conversations and ideas when we saw this bill that, you know, 48 hours ago, that triples the per diem pay for lawmakers.
Well, but the question's predisposed that they ever had an opportunity for the voters to approve a pay increase. And I think that history has shown us that will never happen. The voters of Arizona have resoundingly, every time a pay increase comes down, have turned it down. What the legislators have said is, look, that avenue is not open to us. But we are paying more for gas. We are paying more for insurance. Housing costs at the Capitol are sky high. And that's a whole different subject to get into. But so this is a mechanism, the per diem is, to actually get them some more money for those kind of costs.
Before we go to break, I wanted to bring up a couple of things just in terms of, we've heard Senate President Karen Fann say this, that in every session there are some lawmakers who are sort of looking for one of their pet projects or something like that. One of the things that has come up that has caused some controversy, of course, is the vehicle license tax situation. And Michelle Ujanti-Rita has gotten some traction on that. Rusty Bauer, Speaker of the House, very excited to get rid of it. At what point does it become politics? At what point does it become actual compromise and actually giving into something? Because there are a lot of people who are wondering about the amount of the vehicle license tax. But then, so why eliminate it entirely? Wasn't there kind of an agreement to sort of have it halfway or something like that? Where does this become sort of, hey, we're going to do some horse trading, and then it becomes like, okay, we're going to give someone everything they want?
Well, that's part of the process, right? Whether it's politicking or horse trading or whatever you want to call it, it's part of the process. And frankly, it's what our founders intended, I think, when they set up this form of government. So, this one is interesting, and I just paid the $32 fee, so I'm a little hard.
I'm not getting that back.
Right. But it's part of a bigger problem, frankly, and that is to our infrastructure costs and our roads and how we pay for Department of Public Safety officers. And so what we're saying now is in 2 years we're going to be back trying to figure out this problem and how do we plan for our roads. And frankly, as it currently stands, there isn't enough money to go around. Gas tax is going down as we go to more fuel-efficient cars, and that's had an impact on HERF funding. So, and that impacts, county roads and city roads and how those are funded too. So it all relates back to we need to have a bigger conversation about how we are going to fund roads in Arizona.
Yes, Sam, that seems like a bigger issue that in some sense is sort of getting buried about, well, okay, you can deal with this, but then what's next?
Yeah, and I think maybe just to pull out a little bit, and of course to what you heard in the clip at the top of all of this with President Fann saying this is how it normally happens, that is true to a certain extent, but in years past there used to be subcommittees to the appropriations and the entire body was involved, and a lot of these decisions were made much more out in the open, so the conversations were had for agency budgets in ways that there was input and open debate and conversation around the different levers that you can pull and the buttons that you can press to make different outcomes possible. All of those conversations happen in a room that is sometimes literally referred to as the cage, right? So there's a lot of debate happening behind closed doors, and you don't see it until the deal is baked. And I don't think that serves any purpose of having this very important conversation where we're talking about, HERF funding, and if anyone is going up north for the Memorial Day weekend, you'll see why we need that VLT tax and wider highways, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and I should bring up, there is a discussion, and largely led by Representative Noel Campbell, who's the chairman of the Transportation Committee, on how we broaden our funding base on roads. He wasn't able to be successful this session, but I expect this summer he'll be putting in a lot of hard work. There are a lot of people around the table trying to figure out how to solve this.
That is Marcus Dell'Artino. Also here is Sam Richard with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We are in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest today, Sam Richard of Creosote Partners and Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic.
All right, so guys, last night the House approved some of the budget bills, the less controversial ones. They were scheduled to come back at 10 o'clock this morning to continue work. I just checked the live stream. Not much going on as of this moment. The Senate floor looks entirely empty. There's some milling about on the House floor. How much latitude is there for horse trading and trying to get lawmakers on board? It seems like the positions are pretty clear in terms of what they want. Sam, how much wiggle room is there to get this done?
So I think to what we were just talking about before the break about how oftentimes the new reality is that when the budget is introduced, it's intended that that is the baked deal. There may be a handful of amendments that are oftentimes in the name of the speaker or the president, which is a signal, right? This is the agreed upon amendment language. And the time only makes that deal more tenuous. That there is chaos that becomes much more of a reality when things aren't agreed to right away. So the fact that they haven't gaveled in yet is, something interesting. If we get to Saturday, if we come back on Memorial Day, tensions are going to be even higher than they already are. You can do this in 72 hours. We are now in hour 50, I think, and we're about 72 hours behind where we should be as far as where we need to be in passing and voting on budgets.
They could very well, you know, adjourn for the day and come back on Monday or Tuesday and keep going. But remember how this process works, right? The governor and the president and the speaker of the House come to an agreement, and then they bring that agreement to the members. And then the members start going through the actual document, okay? And so at some point during their perusing of that document, they may realize that there's something in that budget that they don't like or they do want that's missing or whatever it very well may be. And so we're dealing with that circumstance right now where we've got a couple of members who said, well, I just found out that, you know, X is on page 25 of this document.
Marcus, at the risk of asking a naive question, why does this always have to go late into the night? I mean, for as many years as I covered the Capitol, it always happened like after midnight. You guys have been there watching the sunrise over the Capitol. Why can't they do this during normal business hours?
You know, there was once that it was not the middle of the night that I can recall.
Just once.
But it was bizarre. And frankly, that was even a more odder feeling than doing it at 2 in the morning. But really, at the end of the day, I believe that the answer is human nature. And nothing more complicated than that. As the day, it takes a little pressure in the pot to get everybody to finally come to the realization that look, I'll compromise on this. And when it gets to be about 10 o'clock at night and you're not home, you know, you start figuring out, well, maybe it's time to sort of come to some resolution on this.
Right. And I think that you know, once you start, it's almost like Pringles, right? Like once you pop, you can't stop. And I think that's also the pressure that leadership has in that once they really start moving on the voting of the budget, they can't adjourn. You have to stay there. And just because you have the dynamics of 60 people and all of them duly elected in their own right, they have something to say about every provision of the budget. That happens more in the minority caucus than it does in the majority caucus. But still, there is people who want to elongate the debate, elongate the discussion, and the budget isn't one bill. It's, you know, 12 to 15 bills that are each separately debated, separately voted on, and separately moved forward through the process. So that just takes a long time.
I think what's interesting about today is that there seems to be a feeling, a general sense that today is the day or tonight, late at night, they will sign or die. And I will tell you that I am not as certain. We're going to watch this game sort of play out on Twitter as we start this game called Start Your Own Room. That's been tradition for the last few days that you do on Signy Die Day. And I think some people are starting that to sort of get the momentum going, forgetting that you've got two very passionate members in the Senate who have said, I will not vote for this budget unless. So unless something happens on that issue, we may very well be stuck today.
So do you think that they would signy die, they'd adjourn the session without a budget, come back in a special session and do the budget separately?
Sure, that's always a possibility, or you could just leave it open and come back to work, you know, Monday or Tuesday. What, you know, there's 100 ways to solve the problem. It's just sort of getting it done.
Right.
But the problems don't go away, right? So you've got to actually, because some people are going to have to put in some time and work.
And if anything, the problems get bigger, right? I mean, one of the reasons why there has been such a big push to end by this week, in fact, I was just talking to my mom, who is a teacher. Today is her last day in the classroom, right? There's been a sentiment among the leadership at the legislature that they don't want to be here when teachers are out of school, because it doesn't take you don't have to have a long memory to remember the 75,000 people who marched on the Capitol last year.
Well, Sam, that brings up a topic I wanted to get to. Representative Kelly Townsend, we had her on the show earlier this week talking about fining districts and instead of teachers if it comes to certain political speak in the classroom. And the one that we couldn't really agree upon was whether the political speech is determined by someone who disagrees with that political speech or not. So, and I wasn't sure her answer was necessarily that clear on this, but how big an impact, if any, has last spring's Red for Ed and some changes at the legislature in terms of the House side especially, have teachers, have educators, has the education issue really had an impact this session?
I would say 100%. I think that it has been less explicit than last year because you haven't seen, you know, thousands of red shirts camping out on the lawn every day, but their influence is felt, right? The power of those teachers and the power of the organizations behind them have really been a go-to for lawmakers, frankly, of both sides, who are, you know, making calculations of what to say and what not to say to either purposefully draw the ire or avoid the ire of the teachers. So I think that they have definitely had an impact on this session and will continue if we don't end this weekend.
And Marcus?
I'd say single-handedly the greatest factor on education funding is the economy. And I look, with all due respect to my friends in Red for Ed, they've done a fabulous job. There's no doubt about it. But I think it forgets, it leaves absent the discussion that we are here today because of this economy and there being money to invest in education, which when you look at the governor's proposal about how much money we were putting in, we're actually accelerating school construction faster than what we originally planned, which was a wonderful in its own right. But now we're accelerating that plan. So really, at the end of the day, I think the money in the coffers is what's making the biggest difference.
Well, when you talk about Kelly Townsend, she is one who has said that she will not vote on the K-12 budget bill without this provision in there. That seems like another one, just another sort of, you know, wrangling that has to happen to wrangle support for that so you can get her vote, because the count in the House is they can only lose one Republican.
Right. Yeah, so and those are the pressures, right? Like every decision to, you know, negotiate or cave to someone who says I'm not on the budget unless is a calculation made by leadership. And that's where, you know, someone said yes to Ms. Townsend, so other folks are coming to the table with their handout saying, okay, now it's my turn. And that's where some of the turmoil has led us to this morning, and I don't know what the live stream looks like now, but
they're voting on non-budget bills in the House, and it looks like it's still empty.
Yeah.
Live update.
So yes. I'm going to invoke the word naive to join my good friend and colleague, Mr. Brody. It's 31-29 in the House now. Democrats still say they have no input on anything. Now, Marcus, is that just how it works? The majority, you got the Republican governor, Republican majority in the House or Senate, no matter how narrow, and basically Republicans want to get this done on their own.
I think that, and I bristle at because this continues to be a line that we weren't included in the discussions. Define what the inclusion is in the discussions. I know for a fact that Speaker Bowers has talked to the minority leader. I know that Speaker Bowers, just as a person, is going to have discussions with the minority party. But sometimes the price tag is just too much. Frankly, at the end of the day. So, you know, that's what Republicans are aiming for. Look, we want a responsible budget. We want to do a lot of these good things. But at some point, the price tag gets a little too expensive to dance. There have been occasions where you've been able to pick off one or two Democrats. Usually the old joke is, you know, who's up on the Navajo Nation and can we, you know, talk to them about a community college or a chapter house or whatever that is, and be able to peel off a Democrat vote. That will not be a way to go about it this session, that's for sure.
Sam, wrap this up for us in about 30 seconds.
We're either done at 3 a.m. Friday morning or we'll be back talking to you late June.
Sam Richard of Creosote Partners, Marcus Dellartino for Strategic. Guys, have a good weekend. Thanks.
You too.
Thanks.
The U.S. job market is at a point of being called full employment, as technically there are more openings than people looking to fill them. And that has generally meant strong numbers across the demographic spectrum. Unemployment among Hispanics was at a record low 4.2% in April. Arizona's numbers aren't nearly that strong, though. With me to talk about it is Monica Villalobos, Vice President of the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Monica, let's start with those Arizona numbers. What do we know about how Hispanic unemployment here compares to the rest of the U.S.?
We still have about a 5% unemployment rate overall, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. For Hispanic unemployment, though, that's 5.9%. Mm-hmm. And while these numbers may seem low, what we're realizing is that some of the reasons behind that is the increase in part-time employment. And also what they're calling involuntary part-time employment, meaning it's very difficult to find as many full-time positions mm-hmm. that available. So Hispanics are turning to multiple part-time, which is an involuntary position because, in essence, you're not getting a lot of the benefits that you would get from full-time employment. And a lot of the hours definitely can conflict as well. The other thing that we're seeing here in Arizona is temporary employment. So there isn't a lot of stability. So now you have a low unemployment rate, but it's really based on part-time employment and temporary employment.
Monica, does that come down to the opportunities that Hispanic people in Arizona are getting? Does it come down to the jobs that are available sort of generally around the market?
I think that Hispanics in Arizona are experiencing the same thing that the entire population is experiencing in Arizona. It's a general lack of availability of full-time employment. It's a general lack of availability of stable employment. Thus, the numbers that are increasing in part-time employment and temporary employment. The other thing I will add, and this is something we track at the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, is the rise in business. So in Arizona between 2007 and 2015, what we saw was an increase of only 2% in all small firms in Arizona. However, there was a 70% increase for Hispanic businesses and 116% increase for Hispanic women-owned businesses.
Wow, okay. Of course, there's the concern that maybe around the corner we're going to slow down at some point. So how important is it to prepare and to make sure we have more Hispanic-owned business and Hispanically-owned businesses by females?
It's really critical. What we know is that minority-owned businesses are growing 2 to 3 times faster than non-minority-owned businesses. But there is a perfect storm forming, and that's what we have our eye on. Mm. We know right now that Hispanic and minority-owned businesses, on average, make about $110,000 in annual revenue. Non-minority-owned businesses are making about $500,000 in annual revenue. That gap accounts for an additional $36 billion that isn't making its way into the economy every single year. Mm-hmm. And so unless we can provide the resources for these minority businesses that are growing so rapidly to scale, we're going to have a lot of businesses making very little money. And that impacts employment because they have, if we can't help them scale, they can't hire more people, right? Mm-hmm. And that increases the employment issue.
So how much does the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce need to be at the table for, and I'm sure you are, but how much does it have to be at the table in order to remind people or, see, you know, minority-owned businesses are a major part of what Arizona is trying to do economically, but we need to get it up to scale. How do you get there?
Right. Our efforts have really been around market intelligence. There is a lot of emotion in public policy in Arizona. Mm. And what we find is taking the emotion out of that conversation, just showing the numbers, some of the facts that I've shared with you today, that's just our economic reality. Mm-hmm. It isn't fiction. I couldn't write better fiction, frankly. And it really shows the importance of being able to provide minority-owned businesses with the tools and resources that they need to scale to provide more employment in the state of Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Are we finding that there are greater challenges in other parts of the state as there would be with just the general population? Is Maricopa County doing well? Pima County not as much? And how does that affect the outlook for Hispanic businesses and Hispanic employees?
The difference in geography is critical. We tend to be Phoenix Metro in Arizona. Most of the jobs, most of the population is in Arizona. But what's important is to be able to look to our other cities like Tucson, Flagstaff, Yuma. In particular, our border cities that have a lot of trade income. And I know there are a lot of studies being done by the governor's office and by other organizations to really understand the economic impact that Hispanics are having, not just as employees, not just as business owners, but as consumers as a whole. Mm-hmm. We know now that Hispanic consumers over-index in every spending category than the general population. So for us, we know that nearly $50 billion that's going into the economy is just from Hispanic spending. And during the recession, if you look at 2005 to 2015, those 10 years mm-hmm. where we had a downturn, the purchasing power of Hispanic consumers continued to increase. There was no dip. So I think Hispanic consumers, Hispanic employees, Hispanic business owners are important to Arizona's economy and the future of the economy.
Well, as the Hispanic demographic grows and their influence grows, I imagine that'll be an even easier message to get across.
You would think and you would hope. We know right now that the Hispanic population in Arizona is about 30%, 40% in Phoenix Metro, and more than 50% of our K through 12 system. We also know that 98% of all jobs come from small business. So the future of our economy is sitting in a K through 12 system right now that isn't doing well. And we need to provide those resources. As a Chamber of Commerce, we're reaching back even further and not just providing business education to business owners, but business educations to students much earlier on in their academic career.
That is Monica Villalobos. She is Vice President of the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Phoenix is the fastest growing city in the country. 2018 marked the third straight year that was the case. According to U.S. Census data, more than 25,000 people moved to Phoenix last year, putting it ahead of the next fastest growing cities, San Antonio, Fort Worth, and Seattle. In addition, Buckeye was the fastest growing American city last year by percentage. With me to talk about this and what it means is Anubhav Bagley, Regional Analytics Director with the Maricopa Association of Governments. And Anubhav, what do you make of the fact that Phoenix is once again the country's fastest growing city?
Exciting, but not really surprising. We've talked about the fact that Maricopa County itself was one of the fastest ones, or the fastest one in the country, based on the estimates. And Phoenix, being the largest city, was expected to see this growth. And you can see that as you drive around in central Phoenix or in the outer circle, you see all kinds of growth that's happening. You see all kinds of higher density apartments and condos, et cetera, coming up. So very exciting.
Do we see people moving to different parts of Phoenix? Are there certain parts of town that are seeing more of an influx than others?
Again, when you talk about Phoenix itself, are we looking at Phoenix City itself versus the whole metro area? Because, you know, really the metro area itself is growing by far by quite a bit. And as such, I was just looking at the numbers today morning, and the state has actually grown a lot. Based on these estimates, I was looking at some numbers, and we're seeing 62 of the 91 places in Arizona grew at a percentage that was higher than the U.S. average. And of 48 of these grew at double the rate. So the state's grown a lot. This metro area, the Phoenix metro area, really has been growing a lot. Within the region, you definitely, certain pockets are definitely higher growth, et cetera. You know, obviously you saw that Buckeye is one of the highest percentage growth, but you also see Gilbert, Chandler, Tempe. A number of our cities are growing at a pretty high clip.
So you mentioned Buckeye. I'm wondering what that means for Buckeye in terms of housing and services and jobs and just sort of the general makeup of that community.
Yeah, that's a cool question. So Buckeye really was the highest growth rate, not by population, but as a growth rate. They had a growth rate of about 8.5%. Just as a reference, national average was 0.6%. So they're seeing a lot of growth. That means that, one, it's up providing a lot of opportunity. You know, you're getting a larger population, a larger tax base, et cetera, and everything, a bigger workforce. But the other side is that there are challenges that it poses, whether it's on the infrastructure side of stuff. You've got to have schools, water resources, water sewer, obviously transportation, connectivity. All of those things become issues that the city has to deal with. And so they are working hard. We work with all our cities in the region to plan the infrastructure, the highway side of stuff, the roads, arterials, transit. So these things are definitely things that they have to look at, because at the end, when people and households are looking to move into the region, they're looking for it from a quality of life perspective.
Do you find that people are still moving to Phoenix and the Phoenix metro area for the same reasons they've kind of always moved here?
I think it's changing. I think it's changing. That we did always have a large population that was moving here for economic reasons, for finding a new job, or deciding to move in for a quality of life. But what's also happening is that time we also had a large retirement population, people who were looking to move here for the quality of life and the weather to retire here. I think that retirement side is overall slowly declining. We may be pricing out on that side. but from the economic migration, people moving here for work, for new jobs, for opportunities, I think that's the one that's increasing.
Does the fact that the retirement age population moving here is declining, does that put more pressure on cities to provide jobs and make sure that there is, you know, transit and housing and the kind of connectivity that non-retirement age people are looking for?
I think it's two things that are going on at the same time. You may be seeing that retirement age population is not moving in as much, but we are also seeing our population age in place. So the people who are already here, the baby boomers, we're seeing a lot of population age in place. So definitely we have to continue providing services to them. But the other side definitely is that as we are growing our economy, as we have younger population moving in, and interestingly, we've always had our age, our median age in this region and the state has always been lower than the national average. And that means that that's a great opportunity because workforce is one of the biggest opportunity that we have is to then attract the right kind of businesses and have the right kind of opportunities in terms of education, et cetera, to get that workforce gainfully employed and have good business here.
Do you see any reason to think that this growth and this rate of growth will slow down in the near future?
That's an interesting. We do a lot of forecasts and projections, and I was looking at, we're currently working on a next generation of forecasts, et cetera. And overall, you definitely, as the region continues growing, et cetera, I definitely see that the percentage of growth, the growth rate itself, may start declining over time because we've become so large and we've become so big. But I don't see that happening in the short term. Our socioeconomic projections at this time right now, the most current one, is right now pretty much saying that in the next 30 years, we'll be adding another 2 million people in this region.
All right. That's Anubhav Bagli, Regional Analytics Director at the Maricopa Association of Governments. Anubhav, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
If you've never heard of the Arizona Memory Project, you're not alone. It's like a digital public library. And KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie met the team working to preserve the state's rich past for our future.
One of the things that I think is fascinating that I'm trying to get digitized are these Arizona Safety Statistics, which is a really odd title for something.
That's Brandy Helowa. She's a discovery librarian with the Arizona Research Library, which houses the Arizona Memory Project. Helowa's flipping through an old newsletter filled with stats about traffic fatalities, hence the name.
And it was published by the Arizona Highway Department from the 50s into the 1970s.
Helowa says this is the kind of stuff genealogists go nuts for because it contains a lot of very specific details.
And it has people's names, where the accident happened, the city it happened in. So on this page, we have in Maricopa County, we've got several different accidents. In here, we have one that was a driver that was killed because his right front tire blew out, lost control. He stuck an embankment. That happened at 6 a.m. in 1965.
And it's one reason why she and her team of volunteers and interns are trying to get these tiny time capsules scanned and uploaded to the Arizona Memory Project.
This is our Zoichel scanner. And so this is what we use for some of our larger documents like maps. We have a lot of the National Park visitor guides from Arizona. We'll put those on here.
Peter Grant is the assistant administrator at the Arizona Research Library. He says because all of this falls under the state of Arizona,
most of the state agencies are required to share all of their publications with us, which means when they publish something, they're required to give us copies, both print and electronic.
But what about those older documents, like before photocopying was readily available and when carbon paper was a thing? Luckily, government was really good about making copies.
And sometimes we find fourth and fifth and sixth and even more copies of some stuff because they didn't know that in the 40s and 50s that there would be digital copies. And so they tried to preserve as much as they could, which sometimes results in boxes of things that we have 70 copies of.
Helowa says they recycle those extra copies once they've been scanned.
Get this software up and running.
Back at the scanner, Helowa finishes scanning the sadistic newsletter. Optical character recognition software makes the text searchable. Then it gets uploaded and available to anyone for free. The work can be tedious at times, especially if you're scanning, say, a 200-page document.
But just finding these random things that are interesting that the state agencies published. One of the other things that is a favorite item of mine is called La Roca, and it was a newsletter that was published and put together, a literary journal.
By and for the inmates of the Arizona State Prison in Florence.
And it's fascinating to read the things that they were writing about back in those days, and the art that they put in there, and the poetry, and the short stories is really, really cool.
Ryan Airforth is a digital history and maps librarian. He says there's close to 500,000 items on the Memory Project, so making it easy to navigate is important.
So what I'm doing is I'm going to the Arizona Memory Project website. On the homepage, you can see that we sort of have like these big buttons. So state government, historic digital newspapers, history and culture, maps, oral histories, photographs.
Of people both ordinary and extraordinary, like Josephine Goldwater and Ruth Reinhold, one of the first female pilots in Arizona. And notorious, like Winnie Ruth Judd. There are also photos of places and collections about events, including the deportation of more than 1,000 striking miners to the middle of New Mexico.
We have the Cochise County Clerk of the Superior Court. That one's pretty interesting because they contributed a collection of Bisbee deportation documents. So back in 1917, you have that Bisbee deportation, basically a labor dispute that turned into deporting all the workers.
Airforth says 95 different institutions have contributed materials to the Arizona Memory Project, including the Arizona Historical Society, Charlotte Hall, Arizona Highways, NAU, ASU, U of A, and
Lowell Observatory. They recently contributed a collection that's correspondence between Percival Lowell and A.E. Douglas. And Douglas was actually the one who was doing some site selection. And so this is correspondence between the two of them deciding that Flagstaff would be where they would place the observatory.
For the people in this story, the work is never ending. In fact, there's a vault with hundreds of boxes that have yet to be opened. But within these concrete walls is our history, much of it well known, some yet to be told. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.